The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. My pleasure to welcome to the program today Kim Dower. She's got a new book out. It's called What She Wants, Poems on Obsession, Desire, Despair, Euphoria. She joins us on the telephone in, where are you, Southern California?
I am. I'm in Los Angeles, California.
Excellent. Well, welcome to the program, Kim, and congratulations on your new book. I understand that you've written a number of books. I didn't realize that you were a poet until I heard about this book.
Oh, really? Well, I'm not doing a very good job of getting myself out there then, Vic.
Well, I knew you as something else, and we'll talk about that later. But I think it's pretty cool that you're a poet, and I want to ask about this story collection. I mean, this poetry collection. What's the deal?
Well, you know, the deal, this is my sixth book, and I formatted this book around a word that I read and fell in love with several years ago, a word called limerence, limerence, L-I-M-E-R-E-N-C-E. And I'd never heard the word before, and it is a state of being obsessively infatuated with someone, accompanied by delusions of desire for an intense romantic relationship. Ring a bell, Vic? I mean, have you ever experienced limerence?
I don't think so.
Okay, well, lucky you. But a lot of people have, and I never knew that there was actually a word for it. And I love that. And not only is there a word for it, but it's classified into four different areas. So I thought, wow, I have a lot of poems that deal with this kind of feeling through all, you know, unpublished work. And I thought this collection could be really exciting. It could be a collection around the four areas of limerence: infatuation, crystallization, deterioration, and ecstatic release, which is pretty fun. So this is what the book is. It's the collection of these poems. And a lot of people are feeling they resonate with what's going on here. So that's nice.
My favorite section was the last section, I must confess.
Ah.
I like the deterioration section pretty well, too.
Well, that's interesting. So the infatuation section didn't really move you that much? You like it when things start to break up more?
I liked it. I just, if I had to pick favorites, I did through various sections. I had the most in the last section that really got me. And I'm curious, you have a painting on the cover by Salvador Dali. How the heck do you get permission to use something like that? Did that cost you some change?
Well, you know, I had to sell my house and basically, you know, the publisher just gave up everything. No, you know what, Vic? Anything done before a certain date, public domain.
Oh, really?
Nicest words in the English language, yeah.
No way. I could use Salvador Dali paintings on my book?
Absolutely.
My guest is Kim Dower, and her new poetry collection is What She Wants. And what our listeners want right now, I think, is for you to actually share some of your poetry with them.
Oh, wow. Well, you say the word. Do you want me to read something from that last section?
You pick. I'll bet you you've got some that you love to read.
Well, you know, the first poem in the book sort of sets the stage for what this is about. It's called She'll Do Anything for Food. And a lot of my poems, the title is also the first line. So here we go. She'll do anything for food, the dog walker tells me. She speaks quietly, not wanting to insult her heavy-boned, one blue, one brown-eyed beast tugging at her leash. We did a doggy ancestor test, she confides. Discovered she's part wolf, part miniature poodle. Must be the poodle part makes her so ravenous. Small creatures are ruthless feeders. Think of enraptured rats gnawing their way through orange trees. Babies nursing, sucking so fiercely they can burst a nipple. Think of your heart, size of a throbbing fist, the part of you that will do anything for love.
Hmm. Kim Dower.
Yeah.
I would think that the wolf would be the ravenous sign, not the poodle.
Well, you see, that's the surprise in the poem, Vic.
It is. So what's the process? Yeah. How does it happen for you? How do these poems exist? Where do they come from?
They come from anything from everyday life to a situation to a really strong emotion that suddenly I'm feeling. There's really no such thing as the muse, you know, Nick, unfortunately. It's you have to be awake and look around. If you're a poet, you have to report what you see in a way that hasn't been reported before. So with She'll Do Anything for Food, this was a surprise. I just went out, you know, we take our daily 5,000 steps or whatever we do. And I went out for a walk at lunch, and there was a woman with a dog on a leash, and the dog started jumping on me. And the woman said, she'll do anything for food. And I thought, oh, boy, I better get out of here. And I thought, well, okay. And she did say, we did a doggy ancestor test. And I thought, thank you. Thank you to the gods of poetry for handing this to me. And I went upstairs and I wrote the poem. Of course, you know, I wrote many drafts of this poem, but here's a case where it just literally fell in my lap. But you see, you have to be awake for something like that. You know what I'm saying?
Mm. Yeah.
There are a lot of poems. A lot of my poems come from dialogue, something I hear someone say, an event that cracks me up. Because as dark as my poems can be, I think they're also funny, you know. So I find things funny that other people don't necessarily see as funny. So they can come from anything, really, that goes on during the day.
A lot of these seem to be reflections upon relationships.
Yes. Definitely, they are for sure that. And I think that's why people, you know, are relating to a lot of these poems, because we've had relationships that, you know, love isn't always wonderful and fun. It's sometimes sad, and it's the situation that makes us reflect. But my feeling about this book and these poems is, even when the situation may not be ideal, when you're in a love relationship or under the gaze of limerence, you still are alive. You feel alive. You feel awake and aware. And I think that's a much more exciting state to be in than just not feeling anything. Would you agree?
Sure. And you cover all the stages, from obsession to maybe deep disappointment or delight, or, you know, you pass through all the stages in these poems.
Yeah, well, thank you. That sounds so nice. Definitely. And I also, you know, there's a lot of poems in the book that are about animals, because I think animals also can feel sad and disappointed, you know. And I wonder if animals, of course, animals also have longing. Don't you think?
Oh, for sure. You bet. And I love the way that you you bring us these little snapshots, just a couple of words. You bring us these snapshots, like in your poem, "It Will Be a Small Thing." I just love the imagery in that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Do you want me to read that?
If you feel like it.
Well, Vic, this is for you.
Okay.
It will be a small thing that puts you over the edge. A bottle of water spills on a pile of bills. You slam the refrigerator shut, knock the milk over on the beef you've been marinating. You'll cry out the most horrible obscenities strung together like the pearls your mother gave you right before she died, the ones you lost at that dingy hotel where you never should have been, the name of which you can't even remember.
I love that. Was it the El Rancho?
Oh, wait a minute. The El Rancho. You know, I'm talking to someone in Ohio, actually Yellow Springs, where my brother went to Antioch University a long time ago.
He did.
He certainly did. And I remember visiting when I was in high school, and I thought it was so beautiful. You know, I was growing up in New York City, and the closest thing we had to homemade ice cream was, you know, the milk going bad in the fridge. But, you know, I remember I actually ate homemade ice cream at this little place in Yellow Springs.
Mm-hmm.
It's a memory I have. But there was an El Rancho Hotel in Illinois, I remember.
I'll bet you do. Sounds like you went to Young's Jersey Dairy. He was here at the college, your brother?
Yep, a long time ago.
What years? Do you remember when he was here?
Oh, my goodness. 65?
Oh, wow. Okay, those are the days. Well, you know, who else? You probably are aware of this. Another person I'm sure you remember went to Antioch, and that was Kathy Kamen Goldmark.
Oh, well, Kathy and my brother were good friends.
Were they? Wow.
Yes, they were. They were good friends, and Kathy was a wonderful, amazing person and greatly missed by a lot of people.
I agree.
They went to Antioch. They met there. She was from New York also.
Uh-huh.
She's from Long Island. And, they remained friends until she passed away.
Wow. Gee, yeah. Small world.
It is a small world. See that, Vic? And I teach, or I have taught, I haven't for a while, poetry workshops at Antioch here in Los Angeles.
Which, okay.
You know, they kind of did like satellite schools.
Right.
It's a very wonderful place.
Mm-hmm. We like it. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, and we'll continue with our poetry from Kim Dower right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO. I've been joined by the poet Kim Dower on the telephone in Los Angeles. Kim, I would love to hear another poem, but first I need to tell our listeners that they are listening to the Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, community-owned public radio for curious listeners. And how's your rollout been going? I see you've got all these events you've been doing. I'm very impressed.
Well, yeah, I love doing poetry readings. I mean, I really do. I have fun. I like to entertain and enjoy. And so, I'm going all over the place. I've had a bunch of events here in Los Angeles. And then I went to the Bay Area, great poetry town. And I'm headed to Portland next week. I can't wait because you may know a wonderful writer named Karen Carbo. She and I go back a long way, and she and I will be together at Powell's bookstore. And then New York City, my hometown. So I'm keeping this going through the end of April. Of course, April is National Poetry Month for all your listeners. And I'll be doing events throughout the month.
Well,
yeah.
I guess I should probably note that as far as publishing goes, you're kind of connected. Can you explain how that is, what you do, and your other job?
Well, Vic, I have a day job, which is often a night job and a weekend job. It's a business that I have. And the business is called Kim from LA Literary and Media Services. And I've had that company. I'm celebrating my 40th year as Kim from LA, if you can believe that.
I do.
And I handle authors, not poets, because there's no money in poetry, Vic. So I'm not taking money from the poets out there to pay me to get them publicity.
Mm.
And also there's a conflict of interest. I'd rather just keep it separate, you know. But all other writers, thriller writers, memoirists, literary writers, journalists, you know, I promote their books. And I've been doing that for a long time for a lot of people, and it keeps me moving, Vic. You know, it's for a long time. Well, I shouldn't say there was a conflict, but for a long time I kept the poetry and the Kim from LA separate, which is maybe why you didn't know I was a poet. I published my first book in 2010, and it wasn't until like the third or fourth book that I started to merge the two and talk about being a poet with my clients. Because, you know, Vic, it's like in L.A. when you have a waitress come to your table and all you want to do is order your food and they tell you that they're an actor. You know, you don't really care that they're an actor. You just want your, you know, BLT with extra crisp bacon. And so I just thought it would be sort of an imposition to tell people that I'm a poet, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't care anymore because I am, and I managed to, you know, have merged the two. And people are very excited to hear that, actually, clients. They find it, you know, they like it that they're represented by a poet. I also understand what it's like to get in front of an audience and do a reading. I understand what it's like to pitch, you know, a show and get it or not get it. So there's a lot of similarities in the work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember meeting you at the Book Expo out in Los Angeles, must have been 2007. And there's just so many celebrities walking around out there. It's just crazy. You must deal with that a lot.
Well, I did a while ago. I haven't had any celebrity clients. You know, the book business, as you know well, has changed. And, you know, the money that's put into touring and COVID changed the whole atmosphere, changed the whole climate of book publishing. And as you know, back in the day, an author would go to 10, 15, 20 cities and celebrities would go all over. And that kind of stopped. It's coming back a little bit, but for the most part, no one was going anywhere. But back in the day, you know, there was a publisher called Hyperion, where I met a lot of great writers that kind of stayed with me for years.
A guy named Bob Craze, by any chance?
And by any chance, absolutely. I think I booked him on your show. Long time ago, he was one of the first people I ever booked on your show, and you two are still going at it with interviews. And his new book just came out, and I was working on that. And he's as great as he ever was.
That's a fabulous book. That is one of his best books. Yes,
it's
The Big Empty. Yeah, we had him on for that a couple weeks ago.
Right. Well, he's, you know, he's great.
Once they let him go back to his house, that is.
Oh, yeah. Well, we've all been dealing with the tragedy of these horrible fires. So I think back in the day when Hyperion published a lot of celebrities, I did, Tim Allen's book and Burt Reynolds and George Carlin and... there were all these, I mean, it was so much fun. Robert Evans, The Kid Stays in the Picture. I have fun stories about those days because, it was really, some, you know, Burt Reynolds disappeared on his book tour. We couldn't find him. We had people lined up at bookstores all around the country. He just kind of bailed and went back to Florida, didn't tell anyone. And that was, you know, it was exciting. It was really fun when those things happened. Of course, it wasn't fun at the moment. Right. Everyone was flipping out. But in retrospect, it was fun.
Huh.
That doesn't, you know, we don't have that now. It's different.
Yeah. Well, you know, Tom Robbins just died the other day, and I read his obit in the New York Times, and I saw where it said he hardly ever did interviews. And I thought, well, I did an interview with him. But then I remembered that he showed up a half hour late because he'd been down drinking in a tavern in town. And obviously he didn't want to do an interview.
Ah.
But he did.
Well, he did, yeah. I mean, there's always a bunch of those kinds of stories. And now, you know, you wouldn't say that someone missed an interview because they were somewhere drinking. You know, that wouldn't be something you'd say. Because,
well, we didn't say it, you know. But that was what he told me. He said, you know, I was at the bar.
Right. Yeah. But things have changed. I mean, the whole political correctness and the sensitivity. I mean, look, it's good. It's fine. But in a way, it was more fun when you could talk about these things,
Kim,
without repercussions. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, Kim, we're not doing the political correctness anymore. Haven't you heard?
I haven't heard.
Oh, okay.
Reached my day.
No, we're not doing that anymore. Out here in the Midwest, we don't do that. My guest is Kim Dower. Her book is What She Wants: Poems on Obsession, Desire, Despair, Euphoria. I've met some comedians in person, and I don't think that they're that funny in person because maybe they're not supposed to be. They're not performing. I'm curious, was George Carlin funny in person?
No.
Oh, okay.
He wasn't funny in person.
All right.
He was a darling, sweet, sincere, nice person. You never would have believed it because his comedy wasn't that way. And it was sort of had an edge to it. But when you spent the day with him driving around, anytime there was a homeless person on the corner, he would stop the car, get out, give him money.
Wow.
He was really an exceptionally sweet person. And he grew up in Washington Heights. Well, not Washington Heights. He grew up around Columbia, around 120th Street in New York. And his mother was a reporter, a journalist, when it was very rare for a woman to be one. Hmm. And he would tell me stories about her and growing up in New York, not that far from where I grew up. And I found him to be just the most lovely person, but he did not sit around telling jokes in the car, you know. And I think when you're a professional, you save that. You write your material and you save it for the stage. But there are people who are naturally funny who, I mean, Burt Reynolds, for example, was hilarious.
Mm.
I mean, he wasn't a comedian. He was an actor, but he was just funny.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that reminds me of one of your poems, and I know we have listeners out there going, let's get back into the poetry. I love that poem, The Lives They Lived.
Oh.
You know what I'm saying? What the connection between that and George Carlin?
Well, that there's tell me. What's the connection?
Well, you were talking about the life he led. And
Yeah, The Lives They Lived. Well, so you asked where these poems come from. So every year, the New York Times Magazine section they do a section called The Lives They Lived, and they talk about some people and what they had done. And I always found that interesting. I love to know. Of course, we all do, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of a prompt for me. I'm finding it in my book. You want me to read it?
If you feel like it, sure.
I study the dead. What drove that woman out of the farmhouse? Why did he kill his lover? How did she lose her mind? What made him fly so many missions? I will be dead one day. No more roses to forget to smell. No need to know the outside temperature. Wait for the coffee to drip. What will people remember? What might they say? She kept a hidden locker filled with typewriters, Royals, Adlers, Remingtons, Olympias. She ordered birthday presents for her youngest child 2 days before she died. She was just a nurse. After her missionary husband died, she went to live with his killers.
I love the images and the typewriters. That just really got me. I could just picture that.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad. That's the whole idea. You know, people always want to know if poetry is autobiographical, particularly this book. Is this autobiographical? And you know what? No, it's not. We make up stuff just like all writers. It's like when you're talking to a thriller writer, you don't ask him if he really chopped up the bodies and hid them in his trunk.
Right.
But people want to ask poets, did you really do such and such?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is because poems are so intimate and they make you feel like you know the poet, when in fact, you're just connecting with yourself in a lot of ways. That's what a good poem will do. It will help you connect with your own emotions and your own thoughts. The poem is just the sort of the vessel to bring you to that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, there's some things that really happened, you know.
Yeah.
She'll do anything for food. That happened. But then you kind of move it around a little bit, you know, and you make some stuff up.
Right. Well, I just had a flash when you're saying that to that same conference in 2007. And we were leaving the convention center, and it was you and me and our friend Bill Young and Robert Craze. Oh. And we split up,
yeah.
And you and Bill drove over to the train station where they were throwing a birthday party for Michael Connelly. And I rode over with Bob. And as we were driving, he's giving me a little tour, which was so cool. And we drive by this thing, and Bob looks over there, and he goes, "That would be a good place to hide a body."
Yeah, you see? You always got to be thinking, Dick.
I was like, you're saying, oh, they don't do that, you know, they just think about it. And I was like, well, you know, he's clearly thinking about it.
Well, you know, somebody ought to go over there and check that place out. But you never know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, writers, no matter what you write, you're always looking for material, right? You're always trying to come up with things. So you see the world through the lens of how can you use this material?
Mm.
Something you see, something you overhear, something you feel, you know, how can that image, how can that material be used in your own work? And it's exactly the same for a poet or a mystery thriller novelist. You know, wow, that's something. I got to make a note. I'm going to put that in my next book.
Okay.
It's like I'm gonna put that in my next poem.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, Kim, it's really been a pleasure talking to you about your book.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Dick. I really do. It was fun.
And they did a lovely job with this. I'm really impressed with the way they did it. And it's called What She Wants, Poems on Obsession, Desire, Despair, Euphoria. Kim Dower wrote it. And it's published by Red Hen Press. They're at redhen.org, which seems to indicate to me maybe they're a nonprofit.
They are a nonprofit. They publish wonderful books, prose, poetry. And they're out here in beautiful Pasadena, California, you know, and they get their money like all nonprofits from various National Endowment of the Arts, you know, the Los Angeles County Arts Commission, all kinds of LA cultural affairs, et cetera, et cetera.
Nice.
Yes.
Well, Kim, thanks again.
Thank you so much, Vic. It was fun.
Do not touch that dial. We've got a little extra time on the program this morning, and following this break, we're going to bring you our special Book Nook bonus segment. It's your bonus segment on the Book Nook this morning. And as some of you might recall, I came into radio as a music DJ. And when I came to WISO in 1993, it was as a music DJ, interviewing authors that didn't start happening for me until the following year in 1994. And I had a lot of musical guests on the program, some of them quite literate over the years. And we're going to bring you a recording I had done probably 25 years ago with a guy named Dave Doman. He calls himself Swearing at Motorists, but the band is essentially Dave Doman and whoever else is playing with him. And he used to come through Dayton, where he started out back in the early 90s, and play one concert a year at the Canal Street Tavern. And that's what he was doing when he visited me all those years ago. And the last time I think he did that was in 2009, when he appeared on Kaleidoscope with Juliet Fromholt. And he was doing the same thing, going to the much-beloved Canal Street Tavern for his yearly concert. I don't know what he's up to these days. I tried to Google him. I don't think he's put out an album in at least 10 years, and I think he's still living in Hamburg, Germany. Let's revisit now this interview I did with Dave Doman, playing some music and talking quite a bit on the Best of the Booknook bonus segment.
This is a Swearing Motorist original composition, ladies and gentlemen, called This Flag Signals Goodbye. I'll do a little bit different since I can't. Just remember, she said, this is what you wanted. You asked for this. You asked for it. Somewhere an empty room filled with the sound of a ringing phone. It's 4 a.m. where you are. Wonder if you're not at home, and everything you ever said has lodged itself into my head, and my heart sinks as I realize that your phone is by your bed. And this flag signals goodbye. This flag signals goodbye. Quick glance becomes the first half of the second chance, passing each mile takes me. If everything you're feeling is written on your face, perhaps you need a mirror to proofread for mistakes. If it mattered, you would ask me. And if I cared, you would not see that some things have no reason, and it's best to let them be. This flag signals goodbye. This flag signals goodbye.
This flag signals goodbye. Swearing at Motorists on WYSO. What was her name?
Who?
You know.
Nah, that's not funny.
You know who. You get a lot of inspiration from bad stuff, don't you?
Well, I wouldn't, you know, it doesn't have to be bad. It can just be, you know, ends not in everyone's the way they want it.
Yeah.
Nothing's bad, you know. I guess there is some bad, but
But it was good.
Yeah, everything's, yes.
To appreciate the bad, you got to have it good, right?
I think I have it pretty good.
Yeah, okay.
I feel very fortunate that I get to do this.
So what was her name?
That's not funny. Oh, sorry. I'm banging
the microphone. I'm sorry. You know, I very rarely
get finally at a loss for words.
You know, it's hard to put you on the spot, and I just thought, well, you know, if I can do it, I'm going to try.
Yeah, there you go, buddy.
Yeah.
You know, it's art, man. It's not real life.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I must say, I love the new album, and your label, Secretly Canadian in Indiana, was kind enough to send out a copy, Toot Sweet, when they heard that you were coming down the highway in this direction, or the flyway. I understand you flew into town.
Yeah, because I started and ended the tour that I just did in Austin. There was a show at the beginning and at the end, and it made more sense since I was riding with the opening acts to just fly down and ride with them rather than to drive around.
Well, in this particular unnamed music magazine, they in this issue, the July issue, they actually have a compilation in here, and it's got a song on it by Swearing at Motorists, and it's
CD?
A song that you just did.
Really?
You didn't even know that, did you?
No. I've been in a van. I mean, here's what I see. I see the Weather Channel sometimes, and I try to find NPR wherever I am or PRI, and I don't know. I don't really see very many music magazines, but I hear things from people at shows, and it makes me very excited. And I'm going to do this whether anyone writes about it, whether anyone plays it on the radio. This is what I do. I love it.
Well, to quote this review again, it says, the Ohio-born former Guided by Voices sound man focuses most of his attention on an ex-girlfriend, coming clean with lines like, "Didn't realize I was so affected, and now I don't know what to do. And I'm hoping that you're feeling the same way, because all I want for Christmas is you."
Yeah, well,
I got him again. You can't say anything. Don't you just hate that?
Because I like to think of myself as at times eloquent. at least playfully stuttering, if nothing else.
Yeah.
But you just got me just stumped over here.
Well,
Vic,
you know, sing a song, man. That's the cure, right?
Actually, this is the Smiths.
Okay.
Good times for a change. See the luck I've had. Make a good man turn back. So please, please, please let me. I want, Lord knows, it would be the first time. Haven't had a dream long time. See the life I've had. Turn a good man bad. So for once in my life, let me get what I want. Lord knows, if would be the first time. Lord knows, if would be the first time. This is a song about one of my other favorite cities. I mean, there's a lot of them out there. I'd really like to. Traveling is the best part about being in a band, I think, is that you get to, it is like a traveling family reunion. Like, you have a little clan in every city, and besides Dayton, this is another place that really feels like home for me. And I don't need Rand McNally in my hand to put Nashville in my eye. It's 24, 40, or 65. Heading down to the south side, looking for good time. 27th and Poston's where you'll find me and my friend, me and my friend. And there's a bartender in there, ask her and she'll swear that her life is some Towns Van Zandt song. Wonder which one. And I don't need Rand McNally in my hand to put Nashville in my eye. Twenty-four, 40, or 65. 24, 40, or 65.
You strike me as the kind of guy, Dave, that occasionally, just for the fun of it, maybe just kind of makes up a song on the spot.
Yeah.
Yeah, you strike me as that kind of guy, because Dan Byrne's another guy like that. You know, Dan Byrne is like so totally wild and crazy that he can make up. He made up a song when he was in Dayton recently about playing tennis with Wilt Chamberlain. It was absolutely hysterical.
Did he really play with Wilt?
Well, I don't think so, but he made it up.
Well, I don't know anything about Wilt Chamberlain.
Yeah, well, I don't think he did either, but it was very funny. So, we got time for one more, maybe?
We do.
Okay.
If you do, I do.
Swearing at Motorists.
You want to make a suggestion off the new record, or should I play something?
Whatever you want to do,
Dave. You know what
I'd
like to do?
No, I have no idea. It sort of scares me, though, to think.
Let's just see what this is all about. This is the live radio. We'll just go out on a limb here. I don't know if I know this song. Double bed in a single room, a couple chairs and a dining room table, and the radio plays that Otis tune. I've been loving you for too long, baby, but don't believe it's true, 'cause I could never love you for too long. Why do I do the things I do? I don't know. How about you? Why do you do what you do? You don't know. You just do, and you don't know.
And that was your bonus segment on the program today. I bring you some music performed by Dave Doman, who is known as Swearing at Motorists, recorded about 25 years ago, and quite a literary guy. And I think the last time I saw him was purely by accident. I was on a plane and we got diverted because of bad weather. I don't even remember where I was going, but we ended up getting sent to the airport in Indianapolis and sitting in a gate there for hours. And I looked over across the way and I saw a familiar face. It was Dave Doman, and he'd been diverted from somewhere else. So we got to talk and relieve our boredom together in that airport long ago. And I believe he's still living in Germany. I looked at his Twitter feed, and it looks like he hasn't posted there in about a year, like a lot of other people. And got some sad news earlier this week. Last Sunday, the novelist Tom Robbins died. He was 92. I only did one interview with Tom Robbins, and that was 25 years ago, about the same time I interviewed Dave Doman. And according to his New York Times obituary, alongside works by Carlos Castaneda, Richard Brodigan, and Ken Kesey, Tom Robbins' paperbacks, dog-eared and torn, were common sights on the bookshelves and bedside milk crates of the late hippie era, between the tail end of the Vietnam War and the rise of Ronald Reagan's America. He became one of the rare writers to achieve both a cult following and mega bestseller status, with their meandering plots, pop philosophical asides, and frequent jabs at social convention and organized religion. Mr. Robbins' books were the perfect accompaniment to acid trips, Grateful Dead shows, and weekend yoga retreats, long before those things became middle class and mainstream. Though he kept writing into the 21st century, he continually chose titles that emanated the era's day-glow whimsy, like Even Cowgirls Get the Blues, Half Asleep in Frog Pajamas, and Fierce Invalids, Home from Hot Climates. And that book, which came out 25 years ago, is the one that brought Tom Robbins to Yellow Springs. And according to his obituary, he didn't do many interviews. And I don't think he really wanted to do an interview with me that day, because back in 2000, we did the show live every weekday afternoon at 2 o'clock. It was the third hour of the Excursions music program that I hosted. And he was supposed to be here by 2 o'clock because he had an event at the old Books and Company in Kettering that night. So 2 o'clock rolled around and no sign of him. 2:15, no word, nothing heard from Tom Robbins. At 2:30, three people came strolling into the lobby. One of them was a quite harried publicist, a young woman, and then two guys, and one of them was Tom Robbins. When they came in, he identified the fellow he was with as his lawyer from Toledo. I'm not sure if that was true. I think he was trying to do a Hunter Thompson thing. If you've read Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, you might know the connection and the reason why he claimed this was his lawyer. But I said, "Where have you been?" And he said, "Well," he says, we were down at the Trail Tavern drinking beer." And I don't think he really was planning on showing up for the interview, but he was very relaxed, and he came in, and we did a very short interview, about 20 minutes. And that was it. That was the only time I ever talked to him. And now that he's died at the age of 92, tomorrow morning at 10:30, we're going to bring you that interview that I did with Tom Robbins 25 years ago. And it's actually a very good interview. I was amazed when I listened to it at how funny he was and how many unusual things he said. And my favorite quote from him from that interview was, "My cognitive coif needs a cut and color." And I got it. I understood. He surely had said this many times before, but it was a great quote. We'll bring you that interview with Tom Robbins tomorrow morning at 10:30, right here on WYSO, where we bring you new interviews and old ones at times, and this will be one from 25 years ago. So I hope you'll tune in tomorrow morning as we remember Tom Robbins, who died last Sunday in Washington State at the age of 92.